today, Jane. If you could tell me what the date is today, please.
17th of 6th, 1998.
And could I have your full name and date of birth, please?
Joan Mary Killorn, the 27th of the 11th, 1930.
And where were you born, Joan?
I was born at North Sydney.
Where did you live prior to, when did you first come to Green Valley?
Came to the Valley in 1967, and it was quite a traumatic experience getting out here.
Okay, so tell me about where you were beforehand and how you got here.
Well, I originally, as I say, lived at, well, virtually Crow's Nest, part of the North Shore, and we had been waiting several years for a Housing Commission home. And finally, our number came up and we moved out here to the Valley. Seemed an awful long way when we first came, out in the never never, really. As people say, I wouldn't go to Liverpool for my holidays. It just seemed that far away, but the more often you came in and out of it, got closer and closer to the city.
Did you move to? What type of house?
We moved to the proverbial old fibro house in Aberdeen Road at Busby. And to us at that time when we saw that, it was heaven. Years have changed things a lot, but at that time, it seemed to be the start of a new life.
And you moved down here with your husband?
Yes, husband and four children. At that time, actually, the week that we were given the house, I had just lost a baby daughter. So it just seemed to be the start of a new life.
And could I have your husband's name? Yeah,
Kevin Andrew, and same address. He'd lived on the North Shore most of his life. Previously, before that, lived in the Bondi area.
And did we get his date of birth?
No, his date of birth was the 5th of December, and he was born in 1929.
And he died?
He died in 1971, suddenly with a heart attack. And we had two more children by that stage.
Could you go through your children's names and their date of birth?
Oh, good heavens, fancy asking me that. There's Colleen, and she was born on the 13th of August, 1955. And then there was Gary. He was born on the 27th of October in 1957. Then came Ray. He was born on the 24th of May and 1959. Then came John, and he was born in 1961. And following that was Lynn, who was born on the 13th of July in, good heavens, 1965, and Glenn was born on the he's born on the 24th of August 1970.
Where were they schooled? Were they schooled together?
No, some of the children started school down in Narromboon. And but when we came out here, it was such that the schools were all over the place. In fact, the schools were in areas where there were no houses. So to start off with, we had one of them going to Patrician Brothers in Liverpool, and Colleen was going to St Mary's School at Liverpool. Ray was going to a school over in Miller. There were no houses over there, but there was a school there. And then following that, John started. But all the boys eventually were educated at the Patrician Brothers at Liverpool and the girls at St Mary's, as well, the younger ones went to St. Therese at Sadleir.
So you're still living in the same house?
Still in the same house, same street.
And who's at home now?
The only one at home now is Ray. All the rest have sort of grown up and working. But Ray, who is disabled through a car accident, which happened just a year after his father died, he's the only one at home.
So can you talk to me about how long you've been with Green Valley Radio, its full name, its FM band, and...
Well, I've been with the radio station since its first inception. In fact, it was the brainchild of Frank Scambry, Jim Tumuth and myself. We started it all going, and we were all local residents of the Valley. We were involved with the Video Access Centre, which had started up in the Valley. And when we heard that FM radio... or community radio possibility, although really at that stage there wasn't any such thing. We decided that that's what we'd like to see is the start of a media centre for the area. Probably a little bit in our minds is the Valley was getting an awful lot of flack through the media, and...
This
was in early 70s. Early 70s, it would have been about 1972. And there was an awful lot of flack within the Valley, and we felt that, let's show people that... a lot of it's not deserved, that there are people there that have got get up and go. We didn't, mind you, we didn't know much about radio. We didn't know how we were going to do it at that time, but we decided we were going to give it a go. So we had been going to meetings where they were discussing the possibility of FM community radio. And we decided that we would actually call a meeting of residents and interested people to see whether it was viable and whether there was any interest. So that we did. We called a meeting, and 5 weeks after that meeting, actually at the meeting itself, Rex Harrison, who was a connected with the Green Valley Choir and also one of the local churches in the Valley, popped up at the meeting and said, why can't we try it? So nobody had any reasons why we couldn't try it, but then we didn't have too many reasons why we could try it either, knowing very little about it. But so anyway, we forged forward and did a lot of research and learning in that time. And 5 weeks after our first meeting, we held what was historically the very first test transmission that was held in Australia for community radio.
You talk about this first transmission. Where was it held, the location?
The location for the first transmission we held in Liverpool at the... Video Centre, which was under that time it was called Valley Video, and we were involved with that, and it was held there. It was right opposite Liverpool Radio Station, Railway Station, and we borrowed equipment, and boy, did we learn in a hurry. So we held that very first one 5 weeks after.
Could you describe the equipment from memory when you talk about it?
Talking about it now, it seems really... it came out of the ark. We borrowed reading sets from St. Therese School that the children used to learn reading, and we actually did interviews and talk back because it was close to the local council elections. And here we are with them all sitting up at these reading sets. It worked. We had a tape deck sitting on the desk, our transmitter sitting on a table, and it's hard to believe now the equipment that we did use. Domestic turntables, everything was domestic. We really, at that stage, there wasn't much sophisticated equipment around for use. So it was pretty primitive, and because it was the first, actually the ABC came out to do a tape on us for the news. And of course, when they walked in and looked around and sort of screwed the nose up and had a little giggle, my comment to that was, listen, if you're going to do a send-up of us, pack your stuff and go, because we were deadly serious in what we're doing and we won't be sent up for anybody. Which brought them back to earth, and they did a good story, actually.
Joan, who were the people there that day?
People there that day, there was Jim, myself, Susan Varga, and quite a number of the young people that were connected with the Video Centre. They were all from the Valley. There was Scott Richardson, Trevor Taylor, all those sort of people. But we also had local people coming in that to talk to on air. And we had people coming across from the railway station because we had speakers out on the roof. And naturally we got a phone call from the taxi service to say that could we turn them down because their taxi drivers were listening to us and not listening to their radios. So it was exciting. We had people dancing on the streets to the music. We had visits from all the other prospective community radio people from other areas coming in, and because it was historic. It hadn't happened before.
How long did the transmission last, that first one?
Well, at that stage, when we first applied to do this, it threw actually the government and the department into a tizzy, because they said, well, look, nobody has ever asked to do this before, and there's nothing that says you can do it, but then there's nothing that says you can't. So we said, well, we'll take the answer to be we can do it if there's nothing that says we can't. And we got a lot of support from within the government and the department.
Was it local or state?
No, it was federal, a lot of federal. State didn't want to know about us because radio wasn't a state matter. But the federal government, they were very good, as long as we did it ourselves, because they had no staff, no people.
Can you remember the department at that time?
Yeah, it was the Department of Communications at that stage. And it was, I think it was frightening for them, but also very exciting for them that it was happening. So we went ahead. Actually, we only received the telegram half an hour before we went to air that we could do it. And because it was an unknown quantity at that stage, the transmission, we had to start at 6 o'clock on Friday night and we had to finish at 6 o'clock on Sunday night. We were only allowed to do it for a weekend, and that was all that was permitted. We weren't allowed to use a call sign. We couldn't take advertising or what is now sponsorship.
So the initial transmission ran for 2 days. I believe you have the original tapes from that transmission.
We do, yes. Yes, we do have those tapes, and we guard them with our life.
How much? So that's 48 hours of tapes you have, is that all?
No, actually, in that we didn't tape the whole. Naturally, first time around, some of it wasn't worth keeping, but some of it, you know, the major people that were on there, we did keep.
Okay, So what happened after the 2 days?
Well, it was quite a letdown after the 2 days. We were continuing to get phone calls from people wondering why we weren't on air, still on air. And, of course, the other groups that were waiting, it raised a lot of excitement amongst them. They all started to try and work towards getting test transmissions as well, because that was the only way we were going to be able to try it out. But it was quite a letdown, but it's certainly an injection into the group that we can do it, and that's the way it works. So now we have to really get out there and enthuse the community, brainwash them that that's what they want. And I think the other thought that we always had behind it, that while Liverpool had a lot of groups, there was a lot of duplications of services. So that if we had a radio station in the area, it could act as a coordinating force between all these groups, and people would know what everybody else was doing. Is that better?
Okay, yep.
Yeah.
So we're on to the still on the process of how you got your first location radio gig after the first transmission. So community support was growing, yes?
Yeah, what we did, we organised a number of meetings amongst different groups, community groups. We had one meeting, sports groups at another, and service clubs, so that we'd be able to get to them in, talk to them about the things that interested them most and how they could use the radio station. And that worked quite well. But one of the big problems is the fact that virtually there was no provision in the Act for licences for this type. So it was just a very long road before the Act was changed, the Broadcasting Act was changed to allow for this type of station. They had issued a couple of licences under the old Wireless and Telegraphy Act, which were quite untidy within the system, and they were trying to get rid of that. So it was a very, very long road. And naturally, it's very hard to keep the enthusiasm going at a very high level. So, but we kept a core group of people that were really interested. A lot of young ones were really interested in it, and saw themselves as U-Butte radio
DJs.
Operators. Yeah, and DJs. But I think that with the community radio, that's one of the concepts that disappeared, that radio announcers were gods on a pedestal, that anybody could do it with the proper training. It wasn't just an exclusive right of a few people.
So, Joan, tell me when things started really moving.
We went along steadily. We held test transmissions. Originally, we sort of then had another one probably about 6 months later, and then the other groups then started to have theirs. Like tests within their areas. There were 9 different groups around the Sydney area at the various suburbs. But it didn't look as though anything was happening. We did put in a planning, had a planning proposal for the Sydney area, or the documentation of the areas and statistics. Virtually the department had not done a great deal of research through a shortage of staff, that type of thing. So we were left as a group to do a lot of this. We did form what was called the Sydney Public Broadcasting Association, and we all worked together and met and discussed how we could lobby. And when the planning proposal was done for Sydney, we had a lot of trouble getting it to the minister, who was Tony Staley at that time, and he was just going out of politics. So the idea was, look, it's probably a good time when somebody's going out that they'll go out on a high. So we got the planning proposal to him, in probably a devious way by working out or getting onto Canberra and finding out what his schedule was, and finding he was speaking at a seminar at UTS. So we booked into that seminar. Morning tea time. Here we are, Minister. And this is who we are. He never, ever forgot us. We could be in a room with hundreds of people, but never forgot us. And that's how we got the planning proposal. And things started to move along a bit then, because we, as we were unable to get meetings before, at that he told his secretary, organise a meeting. And that's virtually started to move it a little.
So you had your meeting with the minister?
Yes, we had our meeting with the minister.
Who attended that meeting with the minister?
All of the groups from around Sydney attended that meeting, and because we were part of that. And so we outlined what we were trying to do. He was very sympathetic to what we were doing as well. And, you know, we thought, well, at least we've made inroads now. They're starting to see us as people. And I can remember making a statement that, look, I know we've been going all these years and you hope we're going to disappear and go away, but we're going to be here for as long as it takes. And, you know.
What was the feeling in the meeting?
The feeling was excitement that somebody's listening to us. Somebody's finally listening to us. And also by this time they'd form the Public Broadcasting Association, which was aimed at being a national body, because there were groups that had sprung up all over the place by then. And some of them had these Wireless and Telegraphy Act licences, and they had by then too given licence to two of the institutional bodies at universities. But here we were, the little community broadcasters. We actually were able to lobby to Triple J at that time, and they allowed us an hour on Triple J every Sunday night, and we called our program Radio with a capital C, because what we were after were C-class licences, which stood for community. So we all had input into that. But
what period was that when JJJ offered you that?
That was way back in, that would be probably around about the 1977. I'm not sure of the exact, but around about that period. But we've been all paddling along all of this time trying to get licences.
Who was the person at Triple J, or the, do you remember any names?
Marius Webb was involved there at that stage. As an announcer. I can't think of the others there then, but yeah, so.
And how long did that run? And
We actually only run that probably for about a year.
Okay, so for 12 months you had an hour a week on Sunday. What time again on Sunday?
From memory, it was about 6 o'clock.
And what were some of the issues you used to cover?
Mostly we used it as a lobbying tool, talking about what we were doing and what the groups were doing and what we needed. And had interviews with some of the politicians about the need and that type of thing. Boy, did we learn a lot about lobbying. Here we were, little people from the valley that had never been involved in anything of this magnitude before. Lobbying there with the best of them, actually. Although when I say we hadn't had experience, we went through a similar thing trying to get the Valley Video, which was an access video centre, going. And we got some experience from that. But we visited radio stations probably all around New South Wales, wherever we went. here we were getting information on radio, what was required, that sort of thing. Writing submissions, pleading, and meanwhile building up some equipment as well and raising money.
So from 78 onwards, what happened? You left Triple J?
We they needed that time then, so we sort of gave it up then. But we still went on with our test transmissions. They had actually, along the way with a lot of lobbying, had increased it that we could do 3 days. Then it went up to gradually we were allowed to do a week, which was great. And it eventually got up to 2 weeks. But it was quite important to us because we used to run them as simulator broadcasts, just as though we were on there permanently. But it was a great experience for a lot of young people that had never been involved.
What sort of equipment, when you say you're building your equipment, when you were running these 1 and 2 week transmissions, what sort of gear were you working with?
It was still fairly primitive. But we had by then got up to the stage we were able to buy some new stuff of our own, new reel-to-reel tape decks, microphones, tape recorders, portable tape recorders, that sort of thing. Yeah. So we felt as though we were a little way along. We also had a console of our own by then, and we were training people on the use of that.
Where were you based?
We were based at the still within the Video Access Centre,
which was located at.
That was in originally it was in Big Street, and then moved around into Scott Street. So we were operating from there because didn't cost us anything, I suppose. And since we were involved with the Video Access movement, it allowed us access to people with similar interests.
So what happened? So let's continue.
Well, we went along then and we kept meeting. And in 1981, things started to move. All of a sudden, they call for 9 licences for the Sydney area. It was politically opportune for them to do this at that stage. We always thought that they would only call for 3 licences at a time. But they called for the whole 9. It was probably that they couldn't sort out which one they were going to call for first. And I think it was probably thought that they were pulling the wool over our eyes, that one of the groups was RDJ at Burwood. And it was the time of when Billy McMahon was Prime Minister and looked like getting tipped. That since it was in their area, it was great. And it would have looked bad if they'd have only called for 1 there. So they called for the whole 9, which we saw these notices on the signboards. Couldn't believe it. And it was excitement all around. So then the hearings were held. Ours was the first hearing that was held. And it was by then there was the Broadcasting Tribunal hearing, and it was held at the Liverpool Council Chambers, which was then around in Moore Street. And it was just like a court hearing, actually. It really was, you know, and we'd had to get our supporters together to go along and speak at that hearing. We had a lot of documentation. Our application was quite extensive and quite thick, and that lasted almost all day, that one, and slowly all of the stations, the hearings were held. Ours was not contested because there's a series when they call for a licence that's got to be advertised for so long, and then they've got to time for reply and all this type of thing. So from the time of it being advertised till the hearing was probably nearly a year. And In 1982, our license was granted, and we had 12 months to be on air. So then the work began. I think, as one of our people said, oh, good, now we can relax, we've got the license. But the answer to that was by Frank and myself was, if you think we can relax, now the work begins. It's getting on there and staying there. While you're doing test transmissions, you get people that will come in and do time, but then when you want them on there full time, you have to be a very heavy commitment by those people, and they have to take it as a commitment.
So can we talk about the time? So that 12 months building up, okay, you had your license granted.
Yes.
What happened from then?
From then on, we were busy trying to find premises. We went to everybody. We went to Liverpool Council. They thought it was great, but we haven't got anywhere that we can give you. We've got all these people waiting for accommodation. We then went to the Department of Planning and Environment to find out what properties council actually had, so that we had a bit of ammunition to use as well. We found out all these places. There was one out at on Hoxton Park Road, way out. But probably just putting it a little forward there, we talked to everybody we could to find out what equipment we could get. And we did some lobbying with 2WS because they had been applying before that for a license for a commercial radio station. We appeared at their hearing and supported them. And in return, they had said they would support us if and when we got a license. So they, by this stage, they were set up in an old house out there, and they had built a great new building. And we sort of thought, this would be great. If council will give us a piece of land, we can move that building to Liverpool, because it had studios built in it, everything. We got around and organised that if this happened, getting publicity, we get media publicity, TV publicity, that sort of thing, and this moving. But we couldn't get a block of land that we could get access to with this house. We raised money along the way. So we had to eventually say, look, we can't take the house, but can we take the bits and pieces that are in it, like on-air lights, those we still use to this day, soundproofing, anything that we could use, which they agreed to, and they eventually gave the old building to a scout group. But we did use what we could, and we were very thankful for that. But we went back to council. By this time, state emergency in Liverpool here were getting new premises built around in Pierce Street. So we negotiated that we could store stuff here. And by this time, the video centre project, government had cut off all funding, so that had ceased. So we had to have separate premises. So we moved into the state emergency services, which we are in now. And we set about renovating the interior of that.
What year was this? Excuse me.
This was in 1982.
And the address of
that? Or 81, 82. Yeah. It's 19 Christie Street.
Christie Street, Liverpool.
Yes.
And I believe they're moving you shortly.
Yes, we're moving into the old School of Arts building up in Macquarie Street, which is a big step up because we've got a lovely lot of room. I mean, this is a terrible old building. You were never too sure it was going to fall down around your ears. But it was home to us as a radio station, and we operated from here.
Can you talk to me about, was there a board formed for the radio station?
Oh, yeah. This is one of the probably unusual things right from the beginning. receive a radio license, you had to either be incorporated body, a cooperative or a company or whatever. But you couldn't be any one of these incorporated bodies unless you had a license. So that was one of the things that we had to do, was make sure that the department understood that we couldn't be registered if we didn't have the license. And the same thing with the registrar of cooperatives, that who wouldn't register us because we didn't have a license. So it was backwards and forwards. So eventually the registrar of cooperatives agreed to register all of these groups with the proviso that we were working towards, that was part of our promise of performance, that we were working towards getting a radio license. So it took a lot of convincing, you know.
Who was on the first board?
Our first board consisted of Frank Scanbury.
You can remember locations of where they lived as well.
Yeah, Frank lived in the valley. He lived in Sadlier Avenue at Green Valley. There was myself, who lived in Busby. Jim Tumut, who lived in Busby. I'm just trying to think who else. Another person, Paul Summers, who also lived in the valley. Isn't it terrible just trying to think back all of those years, who was the first one?
When did Peter Weir first get involved?
Peter Weir became involved. He was involved originally with the video access movement. He did the film Whatever Happened to Green Valley, which was used as a social tool, and also produced as part of that, a film on the valley, as what was happening there. And he became involved in working with us to get a video access centre going. So he was always a good friend and a hard worker for us. And actually, when we got our licence, Peter Weir, who happened to be overseas at that time, but he came back, is our patron. So, you know,
your patron saint.
Yes, our patron saint, and also has always been very, very supportive of us.
Okay, so we've covered some of the names on the first board. How did you set up how did the organisation commence? The organisation of people, and talk about what money you were paid if you were, and how you
Well, nobody was paid. There's never been anybody paid on this station. Some of the community radio stations, they have paid managers and paid presenters, that type of thing, but we've never paid. It's always been a voluntary organisation, because any money always goes into the station. I suppose when we started, we grabbed anybody we could get. It's like most community organisations. You've got to work with the people that you're able to convince to join the organisation. But while saying this, over the years, it's been the people that have supported and made it work. A couple of people can't do it on their own. It takes a lot of people and a lot of work. Unfortunately, we had those dedicated people and workers.
So starting up, how did you buy your records, or how did you get all your gear?
We actually bought our own records. Most of our presenters still buy their own records. I often think as they walk into the station with their little biscuit boxes and that full of records, people must think we use an awful lot of groceries here. But, yeah, everybody pretty well. We do have a record library, but unfortunately the record companies tend to support the commercial sector as regards records, not so much the community sector. A lot of the records you get really are the stuff they can't sell. But the presenters themselves are avid music listeners, so that they collect a good collection of their own. They're familiar with their music, and which is good for doing programming.
Just getting back to when you first started off, how many hours did you run a week? And
when we first started, we used to start at 10 o'clock and we'd go till 2 o'clock in the afternoon, because we didn't have enough people for full-time programs, and we had to formulate the programs so we had a variety. And then we would come back at 6 o'clock till 10 o'clock. So we had a break in between during the day. It was untidy doing it that way. So after a period of time, till we worked up enough announcers and enough good program material, we then started at, we started at 10 and finished at 10, but we've gradually increased that now that we start at 7, and we're on 24 hours a day, actually. Yeah, 24
hours. 24 hours.
24 hours a day, we've been on that for about, about 12 years now, 12 to 14 years, yeah. We didn't stay on that short hours for a great deal of time because it was, as I say, it was untidy, and you really need to be there when people tuned in.
So compared to the size of the growth, what did you start with, and how many people evolved on the way?
Well, when we started, we had a core group of probably about 15. It has grown and then it decreases, but then that's the nature, because while those that are interested, and as they're volunteers, oftentimes job situation, moving away from the area, girlfriends, boyfriends, that type of thing, has a actually an influence on whether they stay or whether they go. So you've got a turnover. Sometimes they'll leave for 2 or 3 years and then they'll come back again. But we still have a core group of people that have been in it since the beginning.
Could you name some of the people?
Yeah, we've got Ian Becker, Stuart Archer, Jim Tumuth, that's myself naturally. Oh dear. They're the main ones that have been with it since the beginning. Stuart Archer's a dedicated worker. He's always here when you want him. And that's, you know, it's important.
What sort of themes and issues were you looking at back then?
Back then, our promise for performance was the license that we would respond to the demands of the community. I think we probably had grandiose ideas that we were going to be the be-all and end-all on radio, but it's very hard to actually talk people into doing radio programs of significance, community significance, and they are what is a priority and have always been a priority on the station. Presenters are told when they come here that community programs take precedence over music programs, so that if there's something significant happening in the area, a music program can be taken off, not permanently. We don't take them off permanently, but for to put that particular program on. But it's slow and it's very hard getting people. They're frightened of radio, or same as media, and it's a matter of convincing them that nobody can see you. You can be yourself, and I mean, a lot of good radio announcers are virtually shy people.
It being embraced by the community? Do you have an idea of size and how that, in terms of listeners?
Look, we haven't done a survey. The cost factor prohibits that, but we do get a lot of response via the phone during programs. We have ethnic programs as well on the station, which are very important to those
what
people.
Are they, you know,
Well, we've got a Spanish program, Assyrian programs, German, Persian. We've got a variety of programs, and they're done in their own language so that that gets people listening for something from home. It also disseminates information to those people in their own language, because particularly the elderly people, while they may have been here, living in the area for many years, they've never really learned to speak English and understand English. So it's good. It gets health, matters, whatever needs to be got to those people in their own language.
Frank Scambry. Well, let's talk about Frank for a minute.
Yes.
How did you view Frank Scambry's role in all of this?
Frank has always been a motivator. And Frank was always the motivator behind the group. Nothing was ever too hard, and nothing was impossible as far as Frank went. He kept the group working. Sometimes you'd sort of think, well, why they tell him, we're not going to do it. But everybody always did whatever Frank wanted because he was that sort of person. He had the ideas, he was a tireless worker, and he had just so many ideas and so much dedication. Whatever we were doing, he'd be in there working. Really, without Frank, there'd have been no 2GLF. He was just that sort of person.
How did you fit all this in? Like he worked, was he a full-time worker when?
Yes, he worked full time, but we used to work all night on paperwork, writing submissions, letters, whatever. Sometimes it'd be 3, 4 o'clock in the morning. You'd look at the clock and you'd think, it can't be this late, but it was. But it's amazing how you survived on so little sleep.
When did Frank cease to become involved with the radio station? And what happened from
Yeah,
then?
Frank, because he was a single parent bringing up a family on his own following the death of his wife some years before, time-wise, it was time to dedicate to his family. So he gave up being involved because he was the chairman of the group right from day one. So he gave up the being involved in depth, but he was always there to support the group, always there with ideas. You could contact him any time for suggestions. So he was always part of it while he may not have been here all the time.
So how long ago did he cease to be involved?
Would be probably about 3 years before his death that he'd ceased to be involved. But the interest was always there.
Where were his interests in music? Can you recall what?
Frank loved classical music and more the older style music. That was his main interest. I know when Frank was very ill before his death, I took a large box of classical CDs, and he used to listen to those all of the time.
And what about yourself? What do you have a preference with music?
Yes, I like the older style of music naturally.
When you say older style, can you name some of that?
Well, I like the old Bing Crosbys. I like the Frank Sinatras. I like any good music. I like some of the modern stuff. I'm not quite up with the hip hop. But one of the things, when you're running a radio station, when you walk through the door, you have no religion, no politics, and no likes and dislikes in music because you've got to cater for all tastes.
What about some of the other people at the radios? Can you talk about some of their preferences, perhaps, or
Yes, we've got a group of country music they play, and they live country music. Most of our country music presenters are artists and they're performers. So that's their likes. Actually, we have a country program on at the moment, and we've got a large following for our country music programs. We have one every day of the week, and every country program is different, caters for a different area of country music. We've got jazz, we've got, as I say, the hip-hop, we've got the any type of music there is. It's somewhere on this station.
And you're moving to new premises. Have we gone over that? What are some of your biggest memories here, Joan? It's a big question.
I think some of our biggest memories here is when we were building the place. It was such an old building, covered in cobwebs. It was actually going to be demolished. But we moved in. We did it up. It was like every old building you walk past, in you go and say, what are you going to do with those doors? What are you going to do with those window frames? That glass you've got there, can you give that to us? So everything came from everywhere else. Actually walking through this station, it's one of the things actually I'm going to miss. It's like walking through history. All the glass in my office came from Our Lady of Mount Carmel School, at or the hall that they were using when the school got burnt down at Mount Pritchard. All the framework, even though it's hardwood, of the studios came from Don Symes' old chicken shop on Newbridge Road. He gave us that when he was moving there, that we could actually, what we did was we demolished it because he was building a new section, and gave us $200 for doing the job, the people we had here. And over the years, we've used a lot of community service orders people here. In fact, that's how we built the place, is with that. And it used to be, you know, really exciting with the building, and we'd all have lunch together and that. And they became so involved that a lot of them still pop in to say hello. So it made the going easy for them, but it certainly helped us. So those are the sort of things we've done over the years. Groups of kids coming in from the schools and doing excursions, TAFE courses, you name it, we've done it. We've had busloads of school children coming up from Camden. One day here we had 100 children rotating them through, some having lunch in the yard while we spoke to one group and the other group going through the studios. So there's been a lot of those sort of things, but that's important to us because that's what we're all about. We use disabled, we've had a number of disabled people working here who were actually dedicated to them. The radio station was important. One of those people, Tony Johnson, he was with us for many years. Tony died 4 years ago. And he was born with spina bifida. And this station was the most important part of his life. But I think probably one of the nice things, and I think that says something about community radio, was one of our listeners from over at Hammondville, that used to ring all the programs and make requests. She died just 2 years ago. And the lovely letter that we got, and even at her funeral included on the card, was that people from 2GLF